This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome back to our special election season of The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And my name is Gigi Foster. Hello.
We are back in black.
The black.
Tonight, I announce that the budget is back in the black and Australia is back on track. Yeah! For the first time in 12 years, our nation is again paying its own way. A budget surplus of $7.1 billion. Yeah! A $55 billion turnaround on the deficit we inherited 6 years ago.
That's the Treasurer, Jos Frydenberg. He was a bit pumped there a few weeks back. He announced the budget was back in the black, although it isn't yet, and it mightn't matter much anyway, and the government certainly isn't out of debt, and even that mightn't matter much anyway. Gigi, that's actually the question I've been asked most these past few weeks as we've moved from budget into election. How can the government budget be in surplus, but the government still be in debt?
It is confusing. And that's why today in our special election series of The Economists, we're asking, what is government debt? What is a government budget surplus? And why are some people so convinced that these things matter and other people are so certain that they don't matter? Now, Peter, as an economics editor, I would bet you've covered more Australian budgets than I have spent years in Australia.
Actually, Gigi, more budgets than everyone or than most people have spent in Australia. So I've covered 37. The typical Australian age is 37.
There we go. So based on your experience, why might we say that whether a budget is in surplus or in deficit doesn't really matter?
Because the sums are very big, huge, in fact. So if I told you that this financial year the government will take in $479 billion and it'll pay out in grants, wages, pensions, small defence force, $483 billion.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So both of those figures represent roughly a third of Australia's GDP, which is about $1.3 trillion.
That's right. They're both massive. And they're both roughly the same. And in almost every year, they're roughly the same. Now, some years it might be a bit more, some years it's like froth on a cup of coffee. The difference, you can have a very small change in either of those numbers or both of them, and you have a big change in the surplus or deficit, but not much changes. We are like a household in that most households pump out every month about what they take in. The difference is that Commonwealth budgets are actually usually in deficit. Now,
yes.
Households don't do that.
And I think that parallel to the situation of a household is what can get people so exercised about the government having a deficit. Because a deficit would be impossible for a household to sustain in the long term, right? It's like that quote from Charles Dickens, Mr. Micawber's famous recipe for happiness from David Copperfield. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, 19 shillings and sixpence. Result, happiness versus annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20 and sixpence, result, misery, right? An ordinary household that runs a deficit every year would accumulate debt, which is a measure of the stock of money it owes. Some people confuse the words deficit and debt, but it's really quite simple. The yearly deficit is a measure of flow, and accumulated debt is a measure of the stock of money owing, right? A liability on which interest is paid, just like credit card debt.
Or like a household loan, right?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Be in surplus any year, but I've still got a rather big household loan.
Yep, and that stock of debt that you have from credit cards or any other source of borrowing grows and shrinks every year, depending on how fast you pay it off, and on whether you're generating a surplus or a deficit each year.
But a household that did that, a household that ran continual deficits, if you like, spent more than it earned, it would go bankrupt or its children would end up having to take over the debts. And this is the analogy, and it's completely wrong, that's used about the government, that children will be left with debt. Here's the opposition leader, Malcolm Turnbull. He was big on this during the global economic crisis. Here he is at a childcare centre in 2009.
If we fail to live within our means, if we fail to repair our budget, we will be burdening these children with a massive mountain of debt. We owe it to those whom we should care about the most, our children and our grandchildren.
Oh, horrific, Gigi. But unfortunately, this kind of talk, which is wrong, really, is bipartisan. So here's Labor frontbencher Andrew Leigh just a few weeks ago making the same point against the coalition.
Some people get millions and billions confused. So let's just put it in terms that apply to each of us in the room. Net Commonwealth debt accounts for nearly $15,000 per person. Each of us owe the rest of the world something in the order, or owe government debtors something in the order of a small car.
Gigi, we do not. In truth, we are not burdening our children with much, partly because it's the government's debt, not the children's debt, but also because if we did, 20 years' time, the economy at modest rates of growth will be 70% bigger, probably able to afford to pay off a small car. 40 years' time, it'll be three times as big. Now, if the borrowing is used to help the economy grow, to buy roads for the cars, for instance, that won't be a problem. But there's something more important, something fundamental. Governments and corporations are different to people.
Well, so the difference is clearly people have finite lives, right? So at some
point, I'm going to die.
I'm going to have to settle up, and whatever I owe will have to be paid out of my estate. That's it. End of loan. Governments, by contrast, live forever. There's never an end point.
Governments never have to settle up. Now, that isn't to say that, and neither do companies. I mean, BHP hasn't died yet. The Australian government's even less likely to die.
Exactly. Some companies do go out of business, of course, but in a country like Australia and many others around the world, we expect the government to survive for a very long time indeed. We have what we call full faith and confidence in that idea, and that's why we and the rest of the world consider Australian government bonds a very, very safe investment.
Yeah, and, but that isn't to say, by the way, that the government doesn't pay off its loans.
No, of course.
Every loan.
So, but
as soon as it falls due, gets another one.
So it's important to realize too, Peter, a lot of what the government does with the money that it borrows each year is an investment, as you mentioned earlier. So the government makes investments with the money it borrows into education, infrastructure, R&D, and all of these things fuel the growth and development of our society, making us better off in the future and better able to pay off our future obligations. In fact, Joe Stiglitz, who is a winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, was interviewed a few years ago on ABC's Late Line, saying that governments not borrowing to fund social investments like these would be financially stupid because there are very high returns available from those investments. So then why is it that people worry about the size of the government's debt? Why was it regarded as a good thing when for a few brief years under the Howard government, the government was debt-free?
It was regarded as a good thing, and I think literacy is part of that. But also, by the way, the government wasn't debt-free. It had an awful lot of debt. It sold the story that it was debt-free. It was debt-free in net terms. Now, because it had done a few things that enabled it to be debt-free, it got a lot of money from selling Telstra, things like that. It could have been debt-free, but it made a conscious decision to continue to remain in debt. This means continuing to issue government bonds, which are basically pieces of paper where you borrow, a bit like a bank book. Now, it continued to do that because super funds especially really wanted government bonds. So it made this bizarre decision, and it turned out to be a very good decision, because later we did need to borrow again and the debt markets were open during the global financial crisis. But this bizarre decision to borrow and then use the money to invest, and some of what it invested in was Telstra shares. So it sort of sold Telstra and then it bought back Telstra or kept actually ownership of Telstra shares in a different vehicle. and claimed it was debt-free, which gives you a good idea, perhaps, and this is certainly very important when you talk to this, of the economists have this word fungible. You know the term, of course.
Yep, sure. Money is a dollar is a dollar wherever it is.
Yeah, but it means you can define it in different ways. But in the end, it's this whole concept of having debt or debt-free is oddly a bit funny. Now, having said that, it is not ever, if you have prospects, you have prospects, I have prospects, companies have prospects, it is not a good idea to be debt-free.
Yeah, so it's good to be free of net debt, in other words, for a government to still be in the bond-issuing market, but it's not good to be debt-free if you have upside potential in the future.
It's never good to be debt-free in any terms, unless you're basically at the end of your life, the government isn't at the end of its life. Australia's debt-to-GDP ratio used to be enormous. It was 120% of national income after the war. As our national income grew, it became easier to pay down.
But public debt clearly resonates as an issue, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be hearing about it from politicians during this campaign. High levels of debt are linked in the public's mind to poor economic management. And there must eventually be a problem, because otherwise, governments could borrow all the money that they liked, right?
Yeah, and they can't. There is a problem. But
When you talk about debt to GDP ratio, for example, if you look at other countries, Japan's debt to GDP ratio is more than 100%, but lenders still lend to it, right?
Yeah, there is a problem, but it's not the problem that people think. Because as soon as you say, oh, look, government debt isn't a real constraint, people will think, oh, the government could borrow anything. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like a simple story told to convince people of a larger truth. During the global financial crisis, the Australian government spent money, and yes, it did borrow to cover it, but it probably didn't borrow on the same day. But it knew it was worthwhile because of larger reasons about the real economy, and we'll be speaking about them very shortly with one of the world's leading experts in government finance, in budgeting and money creation. And he happens to be right here in Australia. You're listening to a special election series of The Economists on RN with Peter Martin and Gigi Foster. Debt, deficits, danger, and what's so good about being back in the black?
Joining us now is Professor Emeritus Bill Mitchell, Director of the Centre of Full Employment and Equity at the University of Newcastle and inventor of the term modern monetary theory. Hi, Bill. You've been listening in. Thanks
Hello.
For being on the program. We were saying that budget surpluses are a rarity. In most years, the budget is in deficit. Can you explain the reason for that?
Well, the reason's quite clear, and it's related to the fact that an economy produces a certain amount of goods and services each period, and they hire various inputs, productive inputs, to do that, and they pay those inputs incomes. If those incomes are re-spent 100% the next period, there's no problem. The firms get it right, they keep producing, and the incomes flow. But the problem is, of course, that the non-government inputs, households providing labour and capital and equipment being provided by firms, the problem is that the non-government sector desires not to spend all of its income each period, typically. And so that income that's produced in the past period doesn't flow all the way back into new spending on goods and services.
It saves. The economy tends to save.
Exactly. And there's a desire to save. It doesn't always achieve that, but there's a desire to save, typically.
So is what you're saying that because typically Australians want to save money, and because the government needs to sort of reconcile the national accounts, like we can't have net saving for the entire country, the government must go into deficit in order to balance out the savings that people want to have?
Well, to fill what the economists call a spending gap, they have to fill that spending that the savings withdraws. We could have another scenario, and that is that we save domestically overall and we get a heap of money coming in from the export sector. So, in other words, we draw on foreign savings and foreign spending. But a country like Norway is in that position, and that it can therefore run a fiscal surplus, a budget surplus, and satisfy the domestic desire to save and keep the economy growing.
Would that
but
be
Australia's
what we did?
Not in that position.
What's happening then when the government is in surplus?
Well, this is one of the big misleading things that politicians claim. During the Costello years and the Keating years, he had three surpluses, late 80s. And typically we know that when the government goes into surplus, a recession soon follows. So how come Peter Costello was able to achieve 10 surpluses out of 11 years in government from 1996? Well, you think about what a surplus is. A surplus is the government injecting less spending into the economy than it's taking out in revenue, in taxes. And so, in other words, the government is undermining total spending in the economy, in other words, undermining growth. Now, the only reason the economy can then grow in that environment is if the non-government sector is running a deficit.
In other words, people are spending more than they're earning.
Yeah,
dollar for dollar. It's an accounting situation. It's not an opinion of mine. It's an accounting situation. Now, the reason that Peter Costello was able to maintain those surpluses and maintain the revenue growth through taxation was because the economy kept growing. Now, how did it keep growing when the non-government sector was in growing deficit? Well, because we had financial market deregulation, and that led to the so-called credit binge. And household debt, for example, went from about 60% of household disposable income to around 180%. Mm-hmm. Now, that's quite clearly an unsustainable growth strategy. And typically before that period, when governments tried to tighten up and move towards surplus, when the credit markets weren't as lax as they were after deregulation, we soon hit recession because the non-government sector was unable to fill that gap through credit.
So, Bill, you're making an argument basically that surpluses are maybe ironically or paradoxically a bad thing for the government to run. So let's go to the other extreme. What's to stop the government running a very big deficit in an attempt to, you know, stimulate the economy and compensate for people's desire to save and hopefully grow much more than in the future and maybe not even collecting as much tax? What's to stop it? Where's the barrier there?
Well, the ultimate barrier is the available real resources. The Australian government issues its own currency and therefore, by definition, can't be financially constrained. But what it is constrained by are the available real resources that it can buy.
And that's mainly labour, yeah? And capital as well, but mainly
capital. We're an importing capital country, but it buys capital, it buys labour, it buys land, but typically labour and recurrent type of consumables, you know, like for the education system and health system.
So if the government ran a too big deficit, then it would use up all of the labour, you'd have unemployment very low, wages would be bid up, you'd have inflation. In other words, we're talking not accounting things, which are sort of the simple story, you're talking actual real resources. I suppose that's why the government taxes.
The numbers that come out in budget paper number one, that's, you know, the figures you had the politicians speaking in your introduction, they're basically meaningless without a context. And the context is the state of the economy and the state of real resource utilisation, how close to full employment we are, what rates of capacity utilisation there are in the business sector.
And capacity utilisation is a concept that John Maynard Keynes certainly thought was very important, right? That the government's job was to essentially keep the economy humming along in the sense of not having idle capacity.
That's right. I mean, in terms of evaluating our well-being in material terms, we're obviously materially better off if the economy is producing more income. That means we want to have all of our productive resources in use, being paid incomes. Now, we've in the more recent period, we've added more dimensions to that concept in terms of environmental sustainability. But the fact is that the role of government is to increase our well-being by using its fiscal capacity, its spending and taxation, to ensure that we are producing as much as we can, given the available resources we can.
Well, and we won't do that left to our own devices because we have a natural human desire to save, which makes sense for an individual.
That's exactly right. I mean, for the individual, it's a perfect thing to enhance their risk management and to save for a rainy day, so when your car blows up, you can fix it.
You're listening to The Economists with Gigi Foster and me, Peter Martin, and Professor Bill Mitchell. Debt, deficits, surpluses, and what matters.
So when did this Keynesian view about you know, keeping the economy at full capacity, when did that lose sway over politicians and the sort of policy setting in this area? And we start hearing about, you know, deficit spending is a bad thing. I mean, I remember this from the 80s, right? This was a rallying cry in the U.S. where I was, by the Republican Party. When did that sort of rhetoric start coming about?
Well, I mean, in the Australian context, the first time in the budgeting process that we started to hear that was the last budget statements from the Whitlam Labor government when Bill Hayden took over from Jim Cairns as Treasurer. And those budget papers were the first time they really started this, you know, what we now call a fetish for deficits, against deficits. And that corresponded to the rise of what economists call monetarism, this idea that inflation's the enemy, and that unemployment shouldn't be a policy target. It should become a policy tool to discipline the inflationary process. And that began in the mid-70s.
But inflation is an issue, right? I mean, I remember, again, from when I was growing up, that there were examples flowing out of South American countries of governments printing money, that's how it was described, and so flooding the market with their currency. And then because there was so much of that currency, the demand for it would drop, so the price of it would drop, which means the inflation, runaway inflation.
Hyperinflation.
And you end up with people with wheelbarrows full of paper in order to buy a stick of butter.
I mean, there's no doubt the risk of any spending, whether it's government spending or investment spending by firms, whether it's consumption spending, whether it's export spending coming into our economy, the risk of that spending is always inflation. And in terms of government, the risk is not that the government will go broke, but it will drive spending in relation to the productive potential of the economy too quickly. That's the fact. Now, these stories of hyperinflation, they're normally situations either of a failure of governance, in other words. Zimbabwe's often used as the example in recent times when I was studying the Weimar Republic in the 1920s were used. Now, they're not examples of wild governments, out-of-control government spending. I mean, the Zimbabwe case is very much was a supply-side contraction when the farmers were taken over by the freedom fighters under Mugabe and supply collapsed. So that doesn't give us any example for running deficits. But the fact is that too much spending from any source will cause inflation, and that's the discipline that governments have to be aware of.
You're almost suggesting that this discipline, this idea that we need the budget to balance and we need to keep borrowing down, is like a simple story, like a fairy story, because there's truth in it. But the deeper truth is that not that you don't want the government to spend because it would run up debt or something like that, but that you don't want the government to spend too much because it might cause inflation. And that's a harder story to tell.
It is a harder story. I think going back to your introduction, what drives this irrational concern about the state of the fiscal balance and why Frydenberg can get up there and be celebratory about a number, you know, back in the black, so what, is because we've been encouraged and indoctrinated to extrapolate our experience of households to the government. And as households, we know that we've got to be somewhat cautious about our spending and our borrowing, and we've got to somehow calibrate it over time with our income sources. But we're the users of the currency. The government is the issuer of the currency, and our experience of households provides us with zero understanding and knowledge about what the constraints on government are. And the government constraints are almost beyond our comprehension in that experience.
So politicians will talk to us about being responsible fiscally because people understand bookkeeping from keeping their own books. But when it comes to, you know, stewardship of the economy, politicians won't dare to not inject money into the economy when necessary. Is that right?
Oh, yes. This is a very good point. We all talk about being responsible, both sides do, but they want a 1% of GDP surplus and so on. If it came to the crunch and we had another financial crisis, would the governments abandon bookkeeping responsibility and look instead to the real economy?
Well, you think back to 2007 when the Rudd government was elected with Wayne Swan as the treasurer. His whole narrative for almost a year was how inflation was out of control, how we had to maintain the surplus and increase the surplus. And then within a couple of weeks of Lehman's crashing in later in 2008, within a couple of weeks, we had a sequence of fiscal stimulus packages announced, which were rather large, not large enough, but rather large. And the whole rhetoric changed that we were in a crisis, we had to use the government to defend our economy, and the whole narrative of inflation and surpluses just went out the window for at least 3 years.
And this was, in fact, a return to the past. This was what Menzies did during the 23 years of coalition government. There was really no talk or no serious talk about surplus or deficit and whether it mattered.
I mean, in that post-war period, governments in the Western world adopted what we economists call functional finance, as opposed to what the opposite is called sound finance. Now, briefly, that means that functional finance says that you evaluate the fiscal position and the state and what changes should be made according to the functions of the economy. You know, we've already mentioned it, how close we are to full employment, whether we've got good hospitals and schools, whether our roads are working and our transport systems are working, that there's functions that have to be funded by government, and that as long as those functions are working and effective and efficient, then it doesn't really matter what the state of the fiscal balance is, whether it's a 4% deficit or a 2% deficit, it doesn't matter.
So basically, the government is not a household, and there's very little white space between the parties' positions on budgets and deficits and surpluses and debt, and we really shouldn't pay much mind to those statements.
No, look, it's really disappointing for our democracy that the two sides of politics both are obsessed with these numbers in budget papers that are really have no context and no meaning outside of the context. And it's very disappointing we don't really have our politicians providing leadership as to what the role of government is. It's not to run surpluses or deficits. It's to improve material well-being.
I'm wondering, though, Bill, whether there is a real problem these days. And the problem is perhaps you can even call it insanity, but it's the financial markets. Individuals in it might be sane, but collectively they can act as a pack and they can do things that would terrify countries and politicians. If the financial markets think that Australia is running too many deficits, building up too much debt, they'll sell the dollar, they'll remove the AAA credit rating, they'll put it down to D grade status, and that is real. It didn't exist in Menzies' times, but it is a real constraint on our ability of politicians to do what you refer to as functional finance.
See, I disagree with that. I mean, ultimately, the financial markets are not a power above the legislative capacity.
They're frightening.
They make frightening noises, but when it comes to the crunch, they are not omnipotent, and that's the point. In normal times, the financial markets will never desert a country that is subject to rule of law, that has stable parliamentary elections, that has growth, has high-skilled and well-educated labour force. It's just not rational or sensible for financial markets to abandon an economy like that because
we saw them do it with Indonesia, in the Asian economic crisis. We saw them take a set against, and they came back to those countries, but struth, they created a crisis during their years of panic.
Occasionally, in 1997, the Asian financial crisis was a panic, and one country, as you know, was able to meet that emergency situation without any problems for its currency, and that was Malaysia. And they took the decision to defy the IMF and introduce capital controls.
Defy the International Monetary Fund advice.
Yeah, and more recently in the global financial crisis, the largest banking financial collapse in history was Iceland, that tiny little country. And it was facing Armageddon with its economy. It was so, so vulnerable to the financial collapse. Well, its government also identified that was an outlying emergency, and it introduced capital controls, which have been extremely effective. Now, the International Monetary Fund, which has been the, you know, a leading voice against such constraints against markets, against free movement of capital and what have you, are now saying, admitting that capital controls in deep emergencies where there's speculative runs on currencies can be a very effective way to provide financial stability. Now, I'm not suggesting that Australia is anytime soon going to be introducing capital controls, but the point is that they work, and the legislative capacity of the country provides them with that ability to do that in an emergency. So ultimately, normal times, financial markets are not going to ditch the Australian dollar if the government runs persistent deficits.
Bill, I can see the point you're making. I'm still concerned, I guess because I'm a nervous person, that if you're a politician facing a three-year term, right, and you have a credit rating agency downgrading you, even though you're doing what's in the best interest of the economy by running persistent deficits or people talking about a run on the dollar, if it was me, I'd be scared.
Well, I mean, in the early 2000s, the rating agencies downgraded Japanese government bonds to junk status, basically. And the Minister of Finance was asked at a press conference, well, what are you going to do about it? And he said, nothing. And the bond markets didn't blink. The yield stayed very low. The deficits kept rising. The gross debt kept rising to the largest in the world. And the Japanese economy kept growing quite happily. Unemployment rates stayed below 5%, very low in Western terms. And that demonstrated that the ratings agencies and the bond markets are supplicants relative to the legislative power of a determined government showing good leadership.
So essentially a government can, in fact, triumph, and it just needs to use its power the right way.
Exactly.
You've been listening to The Economists, to Professor Bill Mitchell of Newcastle University, one of the world's leading experts in government finance, budgeting and money creation. Bill, thanks for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Thanks very much.
And we'd love you to get in touch with us about these policy issues relating to the election. Any questions you have, we'll try to deal with them week by week. Please go to Twitter at the address for Peter, which is @1, that's the numeral 1, Peter Martin, @1 Peter Martin, or The Economist's webpage, and tell us what you think.
One day, Gigi, you're going to get on Twitter.
I'm not going to get on Twitter.
You are more sensible than me.
Not about sensibility.
Well, you know more about your own mental health, I think. Next week, a big issue that's bubbling below the surface. Indeed, it's impinging on a lot of people's mental health. The parties don't talk about it much in the election, but immigration will swing votes. Are immigrants taking our jobs? Are we immigrants?
I am.
Right. And are immigrants, such as Gigi, crowding out our cities, pushing up house prices, making it harder to get wage rises? We'll see what we can work out. Goodbye till then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.